Thank you, Martin, and thank you, Ernest. Members of the society, guests, ladies and gentlemen, I am, of course, privileged, happy to be here. I thought the theme that was chosen by our president, he said last night on recommendation of Ernest, was exceedingly apt for this year, for this decade, and as I believe for the rest of the century. Recent discussions of equality in this country during most recent years convinced me that for those proposing it as the primary objective of social policy, the underlying values and the overriding implications do not differ from those to be found in Rousseau and are rarely, if ever, stated as forthrightly as we find them in Rousseau. Knowing how to read Rousseau seems to me just as vital today to an understanding of the scene around us as at any time in the past century or two. I think it was Matthew Arnold who used the phrase touchstone of excellence, singling out certain writers from the past whose works could be used as touchstones, as guides thereby to the present. And while I use the word excellence for Rousseau in a context of many misgivings, I do not take an iota from his genius. He is an authentic masterpiece. There can be, after all, malignant masterpieces as well as benign masterpieces. 30 years ago, this month, in an article in the Journal of Politics, I pointed out the then relatively novel perspective formed of Rousseau's philosophy and the emerging ideological foundations of totalitarianism. More recently, in other work, I suggested that Rousseau's ideas were a better guide to the new left than anything easily derivable from Karl Marx. And today, I would like to suggest that Rousseau is extraordinarily useful to us as preliminary reading to any understanding of writers such as Christopher Jenks and John Rawls, and quite possibly the emerging platform of the Democratic Party. At the moment, we find ourselves in a period of apparent calm, the surface of society again tranquil, the Jacobins, Babouvists, Communards willing for the moment to leave the field to a fresh crop of philosophes. Now, philosophes do not like revolutions, only their intellectual preparation. And from the time of the Sophists in 5th century Athens down through the humanists of the Italian 15th century, the philosophes, encyclopedists proper, and the French Enlightenment, the coffee house intellectuals in the 1840s in France and other parts of Europe, all the way down to the Eric Fromms and Herbert Marcuses and C. Wright Mills of the 1950s, the pattern of the philosoph is a familiar one. First, through moralistic tract and text, present social reality as nothing more than a set of traps, toils, injustices, inequalities, and petty tyrannies. Second, declare all existing institutions, family, church, school, guild, university, etc., to be rooted in either corruption or impotence so deep as to unfit them in any degree as refuge or source of reform. Third, with the aid of philosophical concept, provide some kind of legitimacy for the work of absolute social reconstruction, its necessary elements, of course, being revolution and the capture and monopoly of power. I think it's apparent that our decade, in the 70s, will not be a period of revolution, or at least visible overt revolution, except in a most derivative sense of that word, but a period of preparation for revolution. Tracts and texts will surely make their appearance in much the same luxuriance they enjoyed in the late 18th century, and will also be concerned with the relation between social justice, defined meticulously and unswervingly as equality and the uses of collective power. Two impressive works have just entered the scene, both by philosoph authors of uncommon intelligence, learning, and ingenuity. I refer to Inequality by Christopher Jenks and A Theory of Justice by John Rawls, both at Harvard. They are profoundly Rousseauian in their common attempt to build on the rock of radical equalitarianism, a structure of argument that is one half social nihilism and one half social utopia. I think it's a mistake to label these works as socialist, though I dare say neither author would walk away in dudgeon if such a label were applied, because the implications of these two books go well beyond that historic, yet now slightly old-fashioned word. Socialism, after all, is associated with many values, not always indeed with the value of equality. What is monolithic, however, in both Jenks and Rawls is precisely this value. Their primary hostility is not toward private property, profits, and individual economic enterprise as such, but rather toward inequality in any and all forms in which it may be found in society. Towards the end of his book on inequality, Christopher Jenks says that the major problem at the moment in our society is the fact that a substantial majority of the American people do not consider inequality to be a problem. He leaves it pretty much at that, contenting himself with a statement that, quote, if we want substantial redistribution, we will not only have to politicize the question of income inequality, but alter people's basic assumptions about the extent to which they are responsible for their neighbors and their neighbors for them. In short, Jenks, having given us a vision of the city, he drops us off in the suburbs. Rousseau, as I think you will see, is a much more forthright and determined guide. Turn to John Rawls, whose A Theory of Justice has had extravagantly favorable reviews on both sides of the Atlantic. And as I say, I do not take away from it its learning, its insight, or its intelligence. Here is the tersest possible statement of Professor Rawls's major principles of justice. One, the priority of social equality over all other values, including liberty, achievement, creativity, and so forth. Second, the fundamental injustice of all advantages in society, no matter whether these reflect or spring from social and economic convention or from natural ability. Third, the moral necessity of equalization of economic and social condition in the state, irrespective of underlying inequalities of mind, character, or dedication to purpose. Fourth, the overriding importance of what he calls the difference principle, under which, quote, the social order is not to establish and secure the more attractive prospects of those better off, unless doing so is to the advantage of those less fortunate, end quote. Five, the abolition or heavy reduction of meritocracy from the social order. Now let's turn to Rousseau. As I suggested at the outset, the great advantage of an authentic classic is that by so reading it, we are prepared for the works of those around us. We are even better than prepared. We are quite often able indeed to see where they or their successors during a period are very probably going to be as a result of knowing what has already been done in a work such as Rousseau's. Knowing how to read his political writings is vital. Too often readers go directly to the social contract, which is bound to remain a rather motley collection of epigrammatic, frequently digressive utterances, unless one reaches this book by the very route that was taken by Rousseau himself over a 12-year period of thought and writing, one that includes his three notable discourses, all written prior to publication of The Social Contract. These discourses form an avenue that leads without detour to the central thesis of The Social Contract. The first of them was published in 1750, and it yielded him a prize from the Academy of Dijon, which was then a very favorite spot for the philosophes, which had set the question, has the restoration of the arts and sciences had a purifying effect upon morals? Rousseau's prize-winning answer was in the negative. But the real significance of this short essay, which I believe is the proper beginning to the political ideas of Rousseau, the real significance of this short piece has really very little to do with the question as propounded by the Academy, and much more to do with Rousseau's countercultural position on the morality, the social institutions, and other structures around him in the France of 1750. And it would be difficult to find, either in Rousseau's day or our own, a more eloquent, sustained, penetrating assault on traditional values, traditional knowledge, and institutions. Suffice it to say that for Rousseau, French society, indeed all European society, is wholly corrupt, artificial, and inauthentic. It rests, he tells us, on jealousy, suspicion, fear, coldness, reserve, hate, and fraud. And surmounting even these vices is that of what Rousseau calls hypocrisy. You can remember the word from the 60s. Society, culture, human individuality, all of these for Rousseau participate in hypocrisy, or as others down to our own moment would probably say today, inauthenticity. In a single word introduced toward the very end of the first discourse, the cause, inequality. He writes, whence arise all those abuses, unless it be from that fatal inequality introduced among men by the difference of talents and the cheapening of virtue. This is the most evident effect of all of my studies, and it is the most dangerous of all the consequences. Now pass to the second discourse. This also done in response to a topic presented by the Academy at Dijon. What is the origin of inequality among men, and is it authorized by natural law? Now, this discourse failed to win another prize for Rousseau, but it is immeasurably superior to the earlier one. It's dated 1755, 5 years later. In this discourse, Rousseau uses the device, much favored by intellectuals in the 18th century, of what he himself calls a hypothetical history, and what others in that age referred to as a conjectural history, a speculative history, or a natural history. Its primary intent, whatever it is called, in whatever hands it lay, was to use a very rationalized, generalized, tendentious, hypothetical, so-called history as the structure for an argument of crucial relevance to the contemporary scene. By adroit use of historical and ethnographic and also psychological data, arranged in imagined developmental series, one could prove whatever he wished to prove about the foundations and the nature of his own culture. Rousseau revealed himself to be a master of this form, and in the second discourse we are given a fascinating treatment of the subject of equality and inequality from the time of the so-called state of nature down to the present. Now, the essence of Rousseau's argument in this, as I believe, magisterial second discourse, the essence lies in his belief that all social interdependences, as all manifestations of the social bond, are built on inequalities in the human condition which go well beyond the natural inequalities to be found in the primal state. With the rise of first property, and second, the practical arts of agriculture and manufacture, he says, the advantages of combinations fatal to innocence and happiness began to suggest themselves. He writes, so long as men undertook only what a single man, a single person could accomplish,
confined themselves to such arts as did not require the joint labor of several hands, they lived free, healthy, honest, and happy lives. But from the moment one man began to stand in need of the help of another, from the moment it appeared advantageous to any one man to have enough provisions for two, equality disappeared, property was introduced, work became indispensable, and the vast forests became smiling fields which man had to water with the sweat of his brow, and where slavery and misery were soon seen to germinate and grow up with the crops. Now, he says, for the first time, it became the interest of men to appear what they really were not. To be and to seem became two totally different things, and from this distinction sprang insolent pomp and cheating trickery with all the numerous vices that go in their train. So you see, in that last statement, in the second discourse, Rousseau has brought us back now to the concluding passages of his first discourse 5 years earlier. There he had accounted for hypocrisy and authenticity by the single word equality. Now he has, by his speculative, conjectural, tendentious history of equality through the ages, and with its explanation in his terms of the rise of inequality, brought us right back to the original problem. How to account for the ugliness, the hypocrisy, duplicity of our society, we do so through inequality. Now, it has often been said that Rousseau's desire was to restore men to the primal state, often put in the form of return to nature. This is not true. Nowhere, to my knowledge, nowhere does Rousseau ever advocate any return to the state of nature. State of nature for Rousseau was nothing more than a hypothetical methodological device. It was a means of holding the glass up to the society around him that he detested, but no more than that. Perhaps at most an indication of moral excellence that the kind of people around us should be inspired by. No. What Rousseau advocated was no return to nature, but powerfully, and with lasting effect in the West, discovery of a form of government that would at one and the same time offer total liberation from all social inequalities, and with them all social interdependencies, and membership in a community strong enough by its very nature to protect individuals from themselves, from the conflicts, hypocrisies, and duplicities, which from his point of view are the very warp of human society. And we see this in Rousseau's third discourse. This one first printed as an article in the Encyclopedia, 1755, and republished separately, 1758. This is a discourse on political economy, and I happen to regard this as the most powerful of any of his purely political works, the social contract included. It has a directness, single-mindedness, and lucidity often lacking in the social contract where he yields to the temptation to digress. Every major idea of his political thought, I find, in the third discourse. It is here that he introduces for the first time that powerful idea of the general will. The ultimate derivation of Rousseau's conception of the ideal community is surely, of course, Platonist. Rousseau himself acknowledged Plato as the sovereign influence on his own thinking. And in the Confessions, he tells us indeed that on the day when he turned his children, some five of them, all illegitimate, that on the day when he turned his children over to a foundling asylum for the state to rear, quote, I thought that I was behaving like a citizen and a father and considered myself a member of Plato's Republic, end quote. Now let me summarize very quickly the principal themes of this third discourse. In what follows, I am reading straight from Rousseau, no paraphrase. The first and most important rule of legitimate government is to follow in everything the general will. How is the general will to be ascertained? Must the whole nation be assembled? Certainly not. It ought the less to be assembled, because it is by no means certain that its decision would be the expression of the general will. Besides, the method would be impracticable in a great people, and is hardly ever necessary where the government is well-intentioned. For the rulers well know that the general will is always on the side which is most favorable to the public interest. That is to say, most equitable, so that it is needful only to act justly to be certain of following the general will. Superb. It's a magnificent device. Let us move now into political psychology. If it is good to know how to deal with men as they are, it is much better to make them what there is need that they should be. The most absolute authority is that which penetrates into a man's inmost being and concerns itself no less with his will than with his actions. It is certain that all peoples become in the long run what the government makes them. If you would have the general will accomplished, bring all the particular wills into conformity with it. In other words, as virtue is nothing more than this conformity of the particular wills to the general will, establish the reign of virtue. To form citizens is not the work of a day, and in order to have men, it is necessary to educate them when they are children. If, for example, they were early accustomed to regard their individuality only in its relation to the body of the state, and to be aware, so to speak, of their own existence merely as a part of that of the state, they might at length come to identify themselves with this greater whole. And here is a lovely passage. Should the public authority, by taking the place of the father and charging itself with that important function, acquire his rights by discharging his duties, he would have the less cause to complain, as he would be changing his title and would have in common, under the name of citizen, the same authority over his children he was exercising separately under the name of father. It is not enough to have citizens and to protect them. It is also necessary to consider their subsistence. Provision for the public wants is an obvious inference from the general will. End quotation. Of course it is. So is a great deal else. As a matter of stated principle, Rousseau endorses private property. No doubt most of our contemporary philosophers, Professors Jenks and Rawls among them, do also. It is certain, writes Rousseau, that the right of property is the most sacred of all rights of citizenship, and even more important in some respects than liberty itself. Well and good. But the final pages of the third discourse are concerned with taxation, and it quickly becomes apparent that there are to be no deviations from the strict course of equalitarianism. In a word, property, yes, inequality, no. Taxation must be, he says, not in simple ratio to the property of the contributors, but in compound ratio to the difference of their conditions and the superfluity of their possessions. Superfluities, he points out, include not merely rich furniture and fine clothes, but also useless professions, including the performing arts. In a famous letter to D'Alembert, where he expressed his own white-hot indignation at public performances, theater, dance, ballet, and so forth, he made it very plain indeed that he thought that the achievement of equality and the notion of the absolutely cohesive political bond could never exist in the company or that form of irrepressible individualism that goes into artistic creation. Turn now to the social contract. I wish there were time to refer to his novel, Eloise, his text on education, Emile. There isn't. It suffices to say that precisely the same spirit informs both of these works. Whether it is Wolmar in Eloise, who is the gray eminence, so to speak, the man behind the scenes who is directing things, who from Rousseau's point of view has the absolute intelligence and the coldness of heart necessary to reshape, build, and bring human beings together as they should in the light of his intelligence, or whether it is the tutor, that is Jean-Jacques Rousseau himself, with his imaginary pupil Émile in the second, always in Rousseau, there is this subtle but puissant notion of power. Power as the only conceivable means of saving individuals from themselves and from their own interrelationships in normal society. But we have now, as I turn to the social contract very briefly, we have now, of course, the essential elements of our drama. It is society that by its very nature has embedded in it all of the hateful things which Rousseau had learned to despise and to fear in Paris as a young man. And we have learned that it is inequality that is the root source of all of these moral degradations. And we have learned from the third discourse that power, absolute power alone, is capable of saving individuals from the conflicts, petty tyrannies, and torments of society, and uniting them in a form of community, which would be a perfect and eternal insulation from what lies in the self as it has been conditioned by society. Now we can see what he means by those thrilling words which open the first chapter of the social contract. Man is born free, everywhere he is in chains. The chains, of course, society, tradition, morality. What is the solution to the problem? Which is to find a form of association which will defend and protect with a whole common force the person and goods of each associate, and in which each, while uniting himself with all, may still obey himself alone and remain as free as before. This is the problem that he has set. What is the solution? He is never less than honest, it has to be said for Jean-Jacques. He is never less than honest when it comes to the essentials, much more so, it seems to me, than some of the equalitarian philosophes of our own day, who either have not yet recognized the anchored implications of their writing or choose to turn their eye away. What is demanded, Rousseau says, to achieve the perfect political community is the total alienation of each associate together with all his rights to the whole community. For in the first place, as each gives himself absolutely, the conditions are the same for all. And this being so, no one has any interest in making them burdensome to the others, end quote. Now this is the social contract, conceived in and dedicated to the absolute equality that Rousseau cherished to the deepest regions of his mind. I think no one in the history of Western thought has ever been as psychologically, spiritually, rooted to equality as an ideal as Rousseau. No one has ever explored it so deeply, drawn from it its varied essences, its nuances of meaning. He is a terribly important person to us. In order then that the social contract be no empty formula, quote, it tacitly includes the undertaking, which alone can give force to the rest, that whoever refuses to obey the general will shall be compelled to do so by the whole body. This means nothing less than that he shall be forced to be free. For this is the condition which, by giving each citizen to his country, secures him against all personal dependence. You see, we're back to that theme again of the underlying unalterable tyranny and inequality that lie in every form of social interdependence. We have all of those themes in that statement. And how very perceptive and how correct Rousseau is, sociologically correct. There is one lesson sociology teaches. It is that there is no possible form of social interdependence in which there is not some degree of inequality. So how perceptive and how correct in his development of the theme. and declaring that relationships among human beings as such must be as spare and meager as possible, and that the relation between each human being and the political community must be as close as possible. Quote, each citizen would then be perfectly independent of all the rest of the citizens, and at the same time very dependent on the state, absolutely faultless in the analysis. So does he recognize also the problem that would be created for any general will by the existence of non-political, cultural, social associations in the good state? Very shrewdly, and as I say again, it must be said for him honestly, he distinguishes between the general will and, quote, the will of all, the latter being ascertainable through majority vote and fundamentally worthless. The former, the general will, is sacred, invariably right, whereas the latter reflects only head counting. If the general will is to be allowed fertile soil in which to emerge, and if it is not to be confused with a mere will of all, it is therefore essential, he writes, that there should be no partial society within the state, and that each citizen should think his own thoughts. End quote. Professor Jenks tells us in his book Inequality that the greatest problem now confronting our society is the fact that most Americans do not consider inequality a problem. And it is to the end of declaring justice but a synonym for equality that Professor Rawl seeks moral foundation to the work of educating the citizenry in America, of disabusing them of the inherited idea that there is any justice in inequality. But neither author, so far as I have been able to understand Jenks and Rawls, neither author has thus far faced up, as Rousseau did, to the techniques of power, to the absolute necessity of a socialization reaching the very depths of infant nurture, and of the absolute obliteration of autonomous association of society, its associations and symbols, which will be necessary to the achievement of equality once this fateful road has been elected by a government. As I say, I expect other works following in the 1970s on the heels of Rawls and Jenks to make this point increasingly explicit, but it is by a knowledge of that master philosopher of equality, Rousseau, that we are, I think, prepared for what will begin to emerge in the next 7 or 8 years. Rousseau, in a perfectly brilliant chapter in The Social Contract called The Legislator, comes back once more to the theme hinted at in the first discourse, enlarged in expression in the second, and given full statement in the third. I quote, it is an unforgettable passage, he who dares to undertake the making of a people's institutions ought to feel himself capable of changing human nature, of transforming each individual who is by himself a complete and solitary whole into part of a greater whole, of altering man's constitution for the purpose of strengthening it, and of substituting a partial and moral existence for the physical and independent existence nature has conferred on us all. He, the legislator, capital L legislator, must, in a word, take away from man his own resources and give him new ones alien to him, end quote. As I say, it would be clarifying if some of our contemporary Rousseaus, many Rousseaus, could emerge from the bush to make as frank and profound a statement. If they would accept too, and perhaps they will, the decade is only 3 years along, if they would accept too, as Rousseau did, a few other implications of the quest for social equality. Professor Jenks wrings his hands at the stubborn insistence of a large majority of Americans in holding to belief in the legitimacy of inequality. Professor Rawls treads delicately around the issue of majority rule and political representation, concluding that while there may be a certain expediency in majority government, it cannot claim moral standing in a theory of fairness, justice, or equality. In short, neither he nor Jenks appears willing to go so far as to recommend abolition of either majority will or representation through a legislative body. So how refreshing. The forthrightness of Rousseau, his ingenious doctrine of the general will resting upon not vote counting, but upon whether or not the government is, quote, well-intentioned, end quote, devoted to the public interest and to what is equitable or what is equalizing, his explicit distinction between the general will, which is always right, and the mere will of all, his recommendation of the dissolution of all social structures not directly generated by the state, all of this stamps Rousseau, I say again, as a reasonably honest man, unafraid to set forth the implications of his cherished doctrine, his cherished objective of social equality. And so does his declaration of representative government. Rousseau loathed representative government, which he pronounced to be an iniquitous feudal institution. And on the whole, our philosophes, from the ancient sophists down to our contemporary philosophes, also loathe representation, because too often the prejudices of the congressman from Iowa or Southern California or Maine or wherever may somehow get incorporated in national law. And finally, it must be said for Rousseau that he understood in full the impossibility of instituting equality, and with it, the political community, except for the uses of dogma and the stamp of the sacred. Hence that final, extraordinary chapter titled Civil Religion. People need a religion, Rousseau declares. The social bond cannot exist otherwise. Absolutely correct. No existing form of religion, however, will do, least of all Christianity, which Rousseau detested in its every detail. What must be instituted, he writes, is a purely civil profession of faith, of which the sovereign should fix the articles, not exactly as religious dogmas, but as social sentiments, without which a man cannot be a good citizen or faithful subject. While it can compel no one to believe them, it can banish from the state whoever does not believe them. It can banish him not for impiety, but as an antisocial being, incapable of truly loving the laws and justice, and of sacrificing at need his life to his duty. If anyone, after publicly recognizing these dogmas, behaves as if he does not believe them, let him be punished by death. He has committed the worst of all crimes, that of lying before the law. End quote. In his Confessions, and I close now, in his Confessions, which were published posthumously, Rousseau tells us that in 1743, nearly a decade before the first of his strictly political writings appeared, in 1743, while he was a clerk in the French embassy at Venice, the thought came to him one day, quote, quote, that everything was radically connected with politics, and that however one proceeded, no people would be other than the nature of its government made it, end quote. Not by an iota did Rousseau ever deviate from that conviction. Thank you.